The Christmas season is a delightful smorgasbord of customs that annoys the purists and often confuses and amuses the rest of us. This morning I want to talk about the four main traditions of the season and what they each have to offer us. The first is winter solstice of the Northern Hemisphere that was observed on December the 25th in the Julian calendar. It marked the longest night of the year. After the bounty of harvest, all nature had begun to die. The color green faded from the earth. Death, it seemed, was making an irrevocable advance. Then a significant event happened. The sun turned. Light was reborn to the world. Hope was renewed. And people rejoiced, feasted, and celebrated. In Middle Eastern civilizations, Syria, Egypt, Persia, winter solstice was symbolized by the birth of a divine male child from the dark womb of the goddess. There was no father, as the goddess herself was all sufficient. Winter solstice rituals in Europe involved primarily greenery and fire. Candles were lit to invoke fire. But the most important fire ritual was the Yule log, which symbolized warmth, light, and the continuance of life. Yule, the festival of rebirth, lasted 12 days, now known as the 12 days of Christmas. Greenery was used to celebrate the triumph of the life force. In Rome, temples were decorated with evergreens, especially holly. Pine and fir trees were also decorated with streamers, bells, ornaments of gold and silver. In Britain, holly, ivy, and mistletoe stood out as rare splashes of green in the bare forest, and they too were used in the celebration. At solstice rituals, people sang and danced carols. Some carols today, like the holly and the ivy, date back to these times. Winter solstice rituals have carried on century after century, with many customs being incorporated into our Christmas. The second tradition of the season is that of Santa Claus. He is derived from St. Nicholas, Bishop of Myra in Turkey, modern-day Turkey. It was Greeks back then. And he was born in the 3rd century. Nicholas's parents were wealthy, and they raised him to be a devout Christian. Unfortunately, his parents died in an epidemic while Nicholas was young. Obeying Jesus' words to sell what you have and give to the poor, Nicholas used his whole inheritance to assist the needy, sick, and suffering. Well, over the centuries, St. Nicholas has traveled a circuitous route through Europe, especially the Netherlands, and then to the Americas, through the pens of cartoonists in the 1800s to the jolly red-bearded figure of today. The saint's name shifted to Santa Claus, a phonetic alteration of the German. His mission also shifted from caring for the poor to being a gift giver to all, including the affluent. He's also increasingly in the last century been used as an endorser of consumer products and our materialistic society in general. Yet love him or loathe him, Santa is here to stay. At best, he's a symbol of generosity and a reminder that we have to care for those who have the least resources. At worst, he's a symbol of the I want more greed culture. All around the Santa myth, there is predominantly a sense of fun, merriment, feasting, and laughter. Ho, ho, ho. No wonder it endures. The third tradition is what I call pageant Christmas. This is what society generally thinks is Christian belief. It involves all the nativity characters on stage at once. There are angels, white-winged and robed. There are shepherds, healthy and benign, with a sheep or two in tow. There are kings, wise ones from the east with gifts. There is solid Joseph. There is innocent, placid Mary. There is an inviting manger with an adorable blue-eyed boy in the crib. This happy scene is replicated on Christmas cards and in carols. Love came down at Christmas time. Love, all lovely, love divine. Love was born at Christmas. Star and angels gave the sign. This tradition emphasizes babies, families, togetherness, love, and singing. If one begins to criticize or deconstruct this mythological pageant, then one is quickly criticized by those who do not use their faculties when reading the Bible, and those for whom this togetherness ideal is very important. The critic becomes the Grinch, stealing the fun. So it's easier to live with it. And why not? A lot of our enjoyment of Christmas is tied into this myth. Babies are wonderful, and a birth is a sacred event. Families are important, and the broader family of an eclectic community can produce much kindness. Love is the essence of God, and music is the closest thing we have to God's language. All this is worth celebrating. The fourth tradition is the biblical Christmas. This is not about a baby, but about a man. Historically, little is known about Jesus' early years, save that his mother was called Mary, his birth considered scandalous, and his hometown in Nazareth in Galilee. Yet the writers knew about his adult ministry. They knew he lived and preached a radical tolerance. They knew that he had sided with the poor. They knew he had been a threat to those in positions of political and religious power. Matthew's birth narrative, probably the first, uses scriptures from the Hebrew Bible taken out of their original context to undergird claims about the adult Jesus. The prediction, for example, about a virgin conceiving was not a comment about sex, but about God still being miraculously with them at this point in history. The references to Egypt as another example were saying that the Jesus movement is another Exodus movement, and Jesus a new Moses, a new liberator. The genealogy Matthew constructs links Jesus to King David of old. Yet there are also indications that Jesus' power would be quite different from that of a normal king. Radically in that genealogy, women are included. And not just any women, but scandalous sinners and non-Jewish aliens. They were saying that Jesus' power would be one of crossing boundaries, promoting tolerance and compassion. The creation of the Magi, Zoroastrians, traveling to the manger, likewise serves to underline this theme. The Jesus movement wasn't just for Jews. There are no boundaries on this God. Luke, the other birth narrative writer, similarly gives us an interpretive meditation on the Hebrew Bible that points to the adult Jesus. The birth stories of Isaac, Samson, and Samuel, for example, are used to underline that even in the most unlikely of circumstances, new hope can come forth. As in the early hymn, the Magnificat, Hannah, Samuel's mum, sings of hope, the mighty being brought low, the humble lifted up. And this reversal theme of the mighty coming down, the lowly coming up, politically potent, is emphasized too in the place of Jesus' birth, a religiously impure stable, belonging to a stranger, and his first visitors, shepherds, who in that time were considered petty thieves. The message is that Jesus, the adult, was of lowly origins, who stood with people of lowly origins against the power and wealth of the high and mighty. He was not born in a palace. Similarly, the angels, poetic symbols of the mystery of God, sing of the adult Jesus claiming the titles of the Emperor Caesar. It was Jesus who would save. It was Jesus who would be the sovereign one, the Lord. Jesus' power, though, would not come from riches and military might. It would be an upside-down power, grounded in a life lived in God. So these four traditions, winter solstice, Santa, pageant, and biblical Christmas, they merge together at this time of year. Solstice, celebrating the passing from darkness to light, from barrenness to greenness. Santa, celebrating the power of generosity and challenging us to emulate it. Pageant Christmas, celebrating the magic of children and the power of love and togetherness. And biblical Christmas, celebrating the hope found in the adult Jesus, who lived a life of tolerance and compassion, confronting the boundaries and power of elites. All of these Christmas season traditions are to be valued. None should be discarded. All are to be celebrated. For each nurture our spirits and challenge us to make this world a better place.